ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi there, I'm Sam Hawley, host of ABC News Daily. Our podcast covers one big news story each weekday in just 15 minutes. From history-changing world news to cost of living concerns at home, expert guests and ABC journalists explain what matters most. We cover breaking news and the big challenges of our time. Follow the ABC News Daily Podcast on ABC Listen.
Today, the Australian people have voted for Australian values.
The choice is simple for the Liberal Party: change or die.
The public are sick and tired of being ignored.
We need to have more Australian everything. We need to manifest a hyper-Australia.
We've always been about the planet, but we've got to make sure that people have their daily needs met.
People are starting to see that there is actually a different way of doing politics.
Hello and welcome to The Party Room. I'm Patricia Carvelis and I'm joining you from Wurundjeri country in Melbourne.
And I'm Fran Kelly on the Gadigal land of the Eora Nation in Sydney.
So today we thought we would do an extra question time with a bit of a theme. I mean, I love themes. I don't know if people know this about me, but I like invent themes for most things. Questions all about the behind the scenes machinations and optics of Australian politics. These are the things that can be overlooked or perhaps of no interest to some people, but the nerds that listen to us are very interested. They are very important and occasionally spicy, Fran.
Occasionally spicy, that is true. And I have had a lot of people coming up to me or texting me lately saying, hey, I've just listened to your podcast, like people I didn't know. It's fantastic. I just love it. There's a lot of us nerds out there.
Oh, no. Nerds have got good numbers in this country. We are, like, definitely stacking the numbers, Nerdville. Look, speaking of behind the scenes, I'm going to be on the ground at the Labor National Conference, their 50th National Conference. They happen every 3 years. It's in Adelaide. So we're going to bring you analysis from what a significant conference it is, because they've got 94 seats. They have a lot of power, this government, and that conference really sets the tone of the government's agenda. So I think that'll be pretty interesting too. But first, Fran, I know you want to know how we're going with the West Wing.
I do, PK. I was just on the tip of my tongue because I'm figuring you've got to be close to the end now, right?
Middle still, because my daughter studies a lot. So we have to fit them in between our high studies. Okay. So we're all in it. And I have been told that season 5 goes downhill. I can barely remember it. So I hope that this season lasts for as possibly long as it can, if this is the truth. Let's get into the question. Should we do it?
Good effort. Let's do it.
We shall move to questions without notice. Are there any questions? I'll give the call to the Honourable, the Leader of the Opposition.
Yeah.
Prime Minister.
The bells are ringing. That means it's time for question time. This week, our first question comes from Lauren.
Hi, Fran and PK. Lauren from the Barossa Valley here. I wanted to ask a question about broken election promises on the back of the budget. I spent some time in the UK where all of the political parties released a manifesto pre-election, which was a detailed document that outlined their election commitments, and that became something they stick to very strongly throughout the duration of their 5-year term. I've noticed in Australia that our political parties don't release a manifesto. They more drop feed different policies throughout the campaign period. What's the history of not having a manifesto, or why has that not come to fruition in Australia, where we would have a very simple reference document for the election commitments that our politicians are heading into? Thank you for taking time.
Lauren, manifesto. It's such a good word, isn't it? It's got so sort of... It's sort of very Karl Marx-y, isn't it? Okay. Manifestos, yes, I get it. I get what you're saying and I know what you mean in the UK, absolutely. Look, there have been manifestos, so to speak, or a sort of program, broad ideas released by political parties. I've seen them before. I've received, I don't think we've called them that, but, you know, these bigger policy documents of what they stand for. I'm thinking Bill Shorten ran and he announced all of his, how many policies it was, like it was so many that it was, people were drowning in the information and it got them unstuck. So, you know, it's not that they don't put out broad ideas. They do, though, like increasingly, and I think it works to their favour, to have some – they have a plan, right? They go into an election campaign with a plan for the days of the election and the rollout of their themes. But now with modern political campaigning, there is a lot more pivoting and a lot more dumping, can I say. So you might have a plan, we're going to do this, we're going to do that, and then you go, "Up, oh, no, we're not actually going to, that, there's too much, we're releasing too much, we're going to pull that back." So I think they like to have a bit of kind of flexibility in what they do, which is not unwise, by the way. Sometimes you have to bring forward something because, you know, your competition, i.e. the other main political party, or maybe there'll be three main political parties in the next election, who knows, is also kind of going into some territory. You want to go first, set the agenda. So I think if you go to their websites, which barely any voters bother to do, by the way, but if you did, you will find that they do outline their broad political kind of ideology, if you like, and their broad agenda. But they also like to have some, I called it flexibility a moment ago, but some ability to do different things in government. Some things they won't really outline. Of course, you do respond to circumstances. We've seen it with this government where they've done things that they did not outline in, you know, you might see it as a broken promise. Well, they would argue, well, we just had to pivot to different circumstances. So we do it a bit differently here. I don't think it's wrong, to be honest. I don't think you can dictate your entire next 3-year agenda in a world as fast changing as this. We were talking about AI, for instance. AI is basically smashing up everything every 2 minutes. Like, how can governments look at the war in Iran? How can governments really articulate a full vision beyond broad ideas for the next 3 years? I don't think it's possible, Fran.
Yeah, I don't think it's possible. I don't think as the people who elect them, the Australians who elect them, we want them just to be set to a set of things they've got written down. We want them to be responsive to us. We have had manifestos, some high-profile ones in the past. I mean, probably in my time in politics, John Hewson's fight back policy could best be described as a manifesto. And, you know, it got him into trouble because it was sort of very hard and fast, very cut and dried, really. But we're also, you know, heading towards the ALP National Conference. They have the party platform. It is written there. The members at the conference vote and decide on what goes into the platform. But importantly, the governing party, the political party, is not bound by that. It is influenced by that, but it's not bound by that. And yes, as a voter, I'm glad of that. I don't want them to be telling me what they're going to do necessarily, and that's all they'll do. I want to make sure that they can be and are responsive to changing in circumstances, changing in sentiment.
Yeah, and look, there's one more point I want to make about manifestos and if it's totally dictated by the party, back to your party point, and about the Labor conference, which is kicking off and is obviously a big set piece for the Labor Party. Parties' memberships are going to reflect a very ideological worldview, and smart parties will never, I think, follow an ideological worldview for governing a country, because a country is not all left-wing, and in the case of the Liberal Party, a country is not all right-wing. So you have to kind of make decisions that suit a broader-based agenda rather than just the ideological interests of your party. I'll give you an example. The Labor Party, I think in its true heart of hearts, does not believe, I'm talking about its rank and file here, doesn't believe in offshore detention and turning back boats, and yet that's what they do as party policy. They believe that the mainstream of the Australian voting public wants that. In the case of the Liberal Party, they're going to have to deal with some of these issues too. I think the environment and climate change is a big part of that, you know. Where's the public at that on that issue, and where is their ideological base at? They might be also at odds, right? That'll be tested again at the next election. So, you know, if you have a party that follows too closely to an ideological worldview, you lose the public. Elections, one in the centre still, I believe. I'm not moving from that view just because we've seen the rise of some more extremism in the country. I just think it's a trick if they go down that road. All right, our next question comes from Sarah, and it's a written question. I'll read it and then I'm throwing to you, Fran. Hi, PK and Fran. Hi, Sarah. How are the House of Reps seating arrangements organised? Does each member have a House delegated seat by their electorate seat, or does each party determine this strategically? For example, I wonder if representatives such as Ali France sitting directly behind the government speaking position is random or a strategic plant. Female, interesting backstory, popular election outcome. Love your work, Sarah. Oh, Sarah.
Hang on. I'm taking this one.
Oh, no, sorry, but I knew the answer.
I'm taking this one. Sarah, it is not random. Very little is random in politics, can I say, except the events that governments have to respond to. No, it is not random. It is television. It is question time. It is strategically placing people behind the person who's standing at the dispatch box to make sure they're reflective of the image the party wants to give. I think that's fair enough, PK, to a description. What do you think?
Yeah. I mean, I think they design where they sit. You know, the government has this many seats, the opposition, and then they decide where they sit strategically.
And with this current government, the Labor Party has always put more women in view, in shot, to make the point they have a lot of women in the parliament, which they do. They have more than 50% of their parliamentary representation is female, in stark contrast, and this is why they're doing it, in stark contrast to the Liberal Party, which has a tiny proportion of women. Well, they have a tiny proportion of the seats at the moment, but even smaller proportion of women, so it's harder for them to kind of look representative on the cameras.
Yeah, they want to look diverse, representative of the country, interesting. Also, when it's marginal seat holders, marginal seat. Now, almost every seat's a marginal seat increasingly, but, you know, back in the olden days, some are more marginal still than others. They want them. And, of course, if you get your head on TV, you become more recognisable.
Yeah, good
point.
They
want them to get sort of known in the public, don't you reckon?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Next question.
And our next question comes from Jeremy.
Hey, Party Room. It's Jeremy. You hear every now and again, obviously, you've got the Prime Minister, and then you've also got the Leader of the Opposition. But you hear every now and again about the leaders of the Liberal Party or the leaders of the Labour Party, you know, not elected officials, but leaders of the party. I mean, I guess my question is, what do they do? What power do they have? Do they affect the direction of policy? Can they tell the Prime Minister what to do? Just curious. Bye.
Well, I'll take this one briefly. I think you're talking about the presidents of the parties, the organisational presidents. And for the Liberal Party, it is currently a very high-profile former Prime Minister, Tony Abbott. And in the Labor Party, it's been for a few years now, Wayne Swan. He's coming towards the end of his tenure. So two high-profile former politicians, do they get to tell the Prime Minister or the opposition leader what to do? No, they don't. Do they affect direction of policy? Well, they do in the sense that, A, they have a public-facing role. They're sometimes asked to give interviews, or they might give conference speeches. Tony Abbott gave a very high-profile and controversial speech just recently, actually. But they don't get to write policy. They don't get to tell the caucus, in the case of the Labor Party, what their policy will be. But do they have impact? Yes, I believe they do, particularly at the moment. What do you think, PK?
Yeah, and we're talking about the presidents, which are obviously more kind of symbolic roles. And then you have the National Secretary, for instance, of the Labor Party, Paul Erickson. Of course, he provides constant research and updates to the Prime Minister.
And advice,
of the things that are concerning people in the community. Recently, the AI policy was announced. Do you think that the Labor Party hasn't been doing research into how the community is feeling around anxiety around artificial intelligence, workplaces, all of that? Of course they do.
But presidents aren't meant to be meddling in...
No, but I'm talking now about the organisational part and research and direction, and this is what, you know, Middle Australia is interested in. All of that informs the cabinet decision-making, for instance, of a political party. And if it doesn't inform it, and I'll give you an example of where it doesn't, Andrew Hirst, the previous boss, basically, of the organisational wing of providing advice to the Liberal Party, he provided lots of advice, let me tell you, about the sort of mainstream issues. And some of it they weren't terribly interested in listening to, Fran. And what happened, I wonder? Geez, they didn't do very well at the last election. Maybe a bit more listening would have been helpful, Fran.
Well, that's very true. But also, I mean, Tony Abbott, for instance, is going on a national listening tour, and he always attracts media attention because he always says something controversial, like the recent speech he gave in the UK, which talked about, he's warned about mass immigration from countries with vastly different cultures. He's warned about that diluting and extinguishing Australia's Anglo-Celtic culture. I mean, these are very controversial comments, and he's putting them out in public. So then that puts pressure on the political leader, in this case, Angus Taylor, to, you don't want to be sort of striking down publicly your national president. So it's, you know, they can have significant influence. And I suggest that Tony Abbott is going to be one of the most influential we've seen for a long time.
Our next question comes from Andrew. And Andrew has written the question. I'll read it. Long-time listener from the southeast of Melbourne. Hello, Andrew. It's an area I grew up in. I know it well. Over the festive season, I overindulged on a favourite British show, Yes, Minister.
Great.
It made me wonder about how does the relationship between the politicians of the day and the public service actually work? Both groups have quite different outlooks. Polly's famously seeing no further than the next election, and if the show is to be believed, public servants eager to avoid controversy. What influences, soft and hard power, do each have on each other? How does this relate to the formation of a political policy? Have there been fractious relationships in the past? What were the consequences? Appreciate the great work you and your team do. It is a really important part of our precious democracy. And I like that you've called it precious, Andrew, because I do think the democracy is rather precious at the moment, rather sensitive. Fran, there are tensions, yeah?
Well, there are tensions because the brief of the public service in a democracy like ours is supposed to be they're there to deliver frank and fearless advice. Now, a lot of people scoff at that because, you know, we've had spectacular, terrible incidents of public service giving advice that they thought were, well, those who were giving frank and fearless being silenced, those others giving advice that they think government wants to hear. I'm talking about robo-debt here. And there have been cases, high-profile cases in the last two decades of public servant secretaries, the department secretaries, being sacked on the arrival of a new prime minister who doesn't really like the cut of their jib, so to speak, usually their ideological jib or what they perceive as the direction they're taking public policy in. And this was when John Howard came in and sacked some of the department secretaries, it was titled The Night of the Long Knives because it was an unusual thing for us to see in our public sector. It's happened many, many times since. And so I think that does lead to a dangerous politicising of our public service. But generally, they work differently. They are there to develop the policies that the government has promised that they are going to implement, or the government seeks their advice on and says, we want to do this, work up a policy. They should be doing that, as I say, in a frank and fearless way and pointing out different scenarios, different risks. They are giving risk assessments. It's for the politicians then to decide what risks and what levers they want to pull. So are they fractious? Yes, sometimes they are. What are the consequences? I think we're always better off when the public service is giving frank and fearless advice and well-researched.
That's right. I think you want a really depoliticised, if I can call it that, public service, you know, where the sort of colour of someone's politics is so devoid and divorced from the advice that's provided, and that, you know, you don't get the suspicions from the political leaders, which I think happened with the Keating, post the Keating era, oh, they're all lefties, you know, yeah. What I mean? Like, must get rid of them, which I think is really unhealthy.
So to go back to your sort of reference to Yes Minister, I don't think the Sir Humphrey equivalent, which is the departmental secretary, I don't think they have that same impact on our cabinet ministers now. That's what I would say.
I think that's right. Next question, I'll read again, comes from Tyson, and it's a bit complicated, so I'm going to make Fran deal with it. I'm sneaky. Hi, Fran and PK. Two quick questions for you. First, has there ever been a time where there have been opposite majorities in the House of Representatives and the Senate? If so, what was it like? Secondly, Why is it that salutations are not used in Parliament? For example, reps with PhDs or MDs are never referred to as Dr. So-and-so. Why is that? Does it stem from the first among equals sentiment? Thanks, Fran.
Last part is easy. I just don't think we go in for titles in Australia. It's all about, you know, fair go for all. And that's why Tony Abbott got into such hot water when he tried to introduce sirs and ladies, knighthoods, that sort of thing. We just don't like it. So I'm kind of glad that we don't do that. I don't think it's appropriate in the House, which is elected, you know, by the people, for the people. Has there been a time when there have been opposite majorities in the House of Reps and the Senate? Well, yes, in the sense that it's rare that that's an elected majority, in that the coalition would get an elected majority in the Senate, but the House of Reps would be firmly, you know, the government of the day would be Labor. But often in coalition, governments often don't have control of both houses. And in fact, when they have had control of both houses, it hasn't usually gone well for them. And I think if you ask anyone in the coalition, they would say that was the trap for the Howard government in 2004. The government gained control of both houses. It was very rare, and therefore they could pass the work choices legislation, which led them down a slippery slope. I think sometimes a government can have a brief control of both houses because there is a crossover period between an election and when the Senate changes. So you can have senators left over who aren't actually re-elected. They're going to go on July 1.
Because the terms are different.
Yeah, the terms are different lengths. So that can be a short-term thing. But generally, it's a healthier thing when governments of the day don't control both houses. In this case, the government needs to get support from either, in the current parliament, the coalition, or a few independents like, you know, the Greens and David Pocock and Jackie Lambie or elements like this. So it just depends on the numbers. Sometimes things go a bit better for the government of the day than others. At the moment, it's not too bad, I think, for the Albanese government.
So what you're really referring to is, you know, that there's a Labor government in the lower house, but the Liberals have got the numbers in the Senate, for instance, right? Which is deadlock, if you think about it ideologically. Because of the way the Senate is elected, it's obviously a different electoral system, the terms. You actually don't get that very often because you have more minor parties, for instance, even now, the coalition in the Senate doesn't have a majority on their own. You know, it's with Labor that they can pass things, or the Labor senators can only pass things with the Greens if they want something. So that's the two pathways the Labor Party has. You know, it's very, very unusual to have the total flipping. And there's a reason for that as well. I mean, if you look at electoral trends or a sort of a landslide or a mood or something that's going on, it's very unusual to have a control situation of one dominant party and then a control of the other house, kind of, even though the voting system is different. Fran, you'd have to say that would be kind of really distorted, right?
Yeah, it would. But, you know, there are very celebrated cases of it happening to some effect. And usually it's because there's a hangover in that gap of the timing between, because the Senate has fixed terms. So the terms of the senators don't always coincide with any elections. And I think that's what we saw during the dismissal, most famously, that the Liberals still contained, had a majority in the Senate. The government didn't have the majority in the Senate, so the Libs had control of it and they could force things like, you know, not passing the budget, and then that led to the dismissal. So it can have the Liberals, you know, held a majority of seats in the Senate and so they could block supply. It had a very significant impact in that case.
It's a very, very interesting question though. I mean, the thing is, one of the best things about our democracy, but the most difficult thing about our democracy, is that kind of, you know, two-party system. It's a lot easier, can I say, in a place like Queensland, where they got rid of their upper house. And I don't know if democracy is best served by that structure, but it's certainly more efficient for a government, isn't it?
More efficient, but bad move for democracy, I reckon. Yeah.
No, I like the checks and balances of the second house, that's for sure. Well, that's it for the Party Room today, but keep sending your questions in because we love getting them. We're especially fond of voice notes, and you can email them to thepartyroom@abc.net.au.
Yeah, there were some absolute beauties today, so thank you. And don't forget, look out for more podcast content from behind the scenes at the Labor Party conference. Make sure you're following Politics Now on ABC Listen. PK, you're going to be all over it. Just don't miss an episode, folks. It's just, you know, really not worth it.
No, it's dangerous, Fran. It's dangerous. See ya.
See ya, PK.